We return now to where we left off in episodes 105 and 106, which was the church in the New World. You know, the postmodern telling of this era, it tends to flatten all European missionaries into a single monochromatic portrait. You know, Eurocentric colonizers who steamrolled the native cultures beneath the wheels of the gospel cart. That simply wasn't the case, and it's a disservice to history to say that it was. Yes, there were plenty of Catholic, Orthodox, and Protestant missionaries who, well, they conflated the gospel with their own culture. Some men carried the cross in one hand and a land deed in the other. But there were also those who genuinely understood the difference, who valued the uniqueness of New World peoples, and worked hard to incarnate the Christian message within those cultures and languages. Now that often got them in trouble with officials back home, who sometimes saw the native populations primarily as a labor force to be exploited. In other words, the impulse to protect the peoples of the New World from injustice, it did not originate with modern advocates of what's called liberation theology. Some early missionaries got there first. We've already considered figures like Jean de Brébeuf among the Huron of New France. This was a man of extraordinary physical and spiritual stature, learned the Huron language, he composed the famous Huron Carol, and was eventually martyred in 1649 with a courage that was so remarkable his captors reportedly ate his heart, believing that his strength would pass to them. We considered the work of Madame de la Peltre in Quebec, and the Russian Orthodox missionaries that were pushing down the western coast of North America, eventually meeting the Spanish that were coming north out of Central America. Turns out Protestants, well, they were a bit late to the game. One of the earliest Protestant attempts in the New World was launched under the patronage of the Huguenot Admiral Gaspard de Coligny. This was the same man that we encountered in that bloody and tragic story of the Paris massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day. At the end of 1554, King Henry II asked Coligny to prepare an expedition to Brazil, and in 1555, the expedition, which was entrusted to the Vice Admiral de Villegagne, he established a settlement on an island in the Bay of Rio de Janeiro, building a citadel named Fort Coligny. Now, here's where the story gets messy, and a little ironic, I think. Calvin himself was applied to for ministers, and after consultation with the other pastors of Geneva, he sent two, Guillaume Chartier and Pierre Richier, whose object was both to labor among the colonists and to evangelize the native inhabitants. That makes this arguably the first Protestant missionary endeavor in the Americas. But it didn't end well. Villegagne was a complicated character. He was a Catholic who had flirted with Protestantism, but then turned viciously against it. The colony was soon riven by a doctrinal dispute over communion, and Villegagne expelled the Calvinist ministers from the island. Four of the Huguenots who remained were executed for their Reformed convictions, writing a brief confession of their faith in the 12 hours before they were hanged, a document now called the Guanabara Confession, the first Protestant writing in Brazil. The settlement didn't ultimately survive the Portuguese military pressure either. It fell to the Portuguese fleet in 1560. But the Protestants tried again. In 1630, forces of the Dutch West India Company captured the northeast Brazilian region, and Recife in Pernambuco became the administrative center of what would be known as Dutch Brazil. Reformed pastors came with the colonists, and the Dutch Reformed Church established itself as the colony's public church. But after 24 years, the Dutch were expelled by the Roman Catholic Portuguese, another promising Protestant experiment extinguished. North America presented, well, a rather different scene from what was taking place further south. The voyage of the Mayflower in 1620 pointed to the powerful influence of Calvinism on what would become New England. The states of Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New Hampshire were strongly Congregationalist or Presbyterian in their church polity and deeply shaped by English Puritanism. At least some of these pioneers felt a genuine responsibility for bringing the Christian faith to the Native Americans. Now, having just worked through the Puritans in England, now's the right moment to take a closer look at Puritanism in the New World. During the reign of King James I, some Puritans grew so discouraged at the pace of reform within the Church of England that they separated from it entirely. After 11 years in the Netherlands, where the Dutch were generally welcoming of English religious dissenters, sharing the same faith and appreciating their work ethic, these separating Puritans grew anxious. You see, their children were becoming more Dutch and less English, and they couldn't return to England, where tensions between the crown and the Puritans were thick. And so they did what desperate and visionary people often do. They got on a boat. They established Plymouth Colony in 1620 in what is now southeastern Massachusetts. The colony struggled mightily at first. Nearly half the settlers died in the first winter, but with the friendship and assistance of the Wampanoag people, it eventually took hold and became a model for other English settlements in that region. Now, back in England, when Archbishop Laud began systematically suppressing Puritans, immigration to the New World accelerated sharply. A Puritan lawyer named John Winthrop began drawing plans for a more ambitious colony. In March of 1629, he obtained a royal charter for the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and a year later set sail with 700 colonists aboard 11 ships. Aboard the flagship Arbella, Winthrop preached what became one of the most consequential sermons in American history, declaring, quote, "We shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us," unquote. Now that phrase, which is lifted straight from Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, would echo across four centuries of American political life. It's quoted by presidents from John Kennedy to Ronald Reagan. Winthrop meant it as a warning as much as an aspiration. He was saying, we are going to be watched. We'd better not fail. Others caught the vision. From 1630 to the outbreak of the English Civil War, well over 20,000 Puritans crossed the Atlantic in what became known as the Great Migration. Now, these later Puritans, they differed from the separatist pilgrims at Plymouth. They still considered themselves loyal members of the Church of England, just the Church of England improved and now established in New England. They had the chance to build in the New World what they had only dreamed of reforming in the old. The New England Puritans held a vision not merely of a pure church, but of a purified society, one committed to biblical principles across every dimension of public life. The concept of covenant was central to their enterprise. And following the pattern of God's covenant with Israel, they promised to obey God and trusted that He would, in turn, bless them. This is why Massachusetts was often spoken of as a kind of New Israel. That covenantal logic required strict Sabbath observance, transferred from Saturday to Sunday, and a family structure in which the father functioned as a kind of domestic pastor, extending blessing for obedience and discipline for the reverse. This social vision required public piety. Secular entertainments were prohibited. Things like games of chance, dancing around the maypole, horse racing, bear baiting, the theater, all of these were banned. Christmas celebrations were viewed as pagan remnants. The Puritan vision of the holy life was rich and at times admirable, and at times, well, it was strange. We're going to be charitable and just leave it at that. Following the Pietist tradition, New England Puritans required a public declaration of genuine conversion as a condition for church membership. And that created a real problem. Children who'd grown up in pious, faithful households, who'd never known anything but life in the church, were now expected to produce a testimony of some kind of dramatic, dateable conversion experience. And many of them simply couldn't. The result was that large numbers of second-generation Puritans were excluded from full church membership, which was the social and spiritual heart of New England town life. Divisions, of course, followed. Puritan minister Richard Mather developed what became known as the Halfway Covenant as a proposed solution, a quasi-membership that included baptism but not communion for the children of church members. The idea was to keep these halfway members within the orbit of the church's influence, hoping that the example of full members would eventually draw them to their own experience of grace, by which was meant some kind of dramatic conversion experience. Not everyone was happy with this compromise. The debate over the halfway covenant, well, it would simmer in New England churches for decades. Now, some historians describe Puritan New England as a theocracy. I think the reality is more nuanced than that. While Governor Winthrop certainly wanted colonial law grounded in biblical principles, he did not permit clergy to hold civil office. Ministers were consulted, their advice was taken seriously, but political authority remained firmly in the hands of laymen. Theocratic tendencies, of course, existed, but the colony's own congregationalism checked them. New England never achieved enough doctrinal unity to sustain a real theocracy, despite what you might conclude from reading certain modern revisionist historians. Here's a point worth noting. The Puritans did not come to the New World to establish religious liberty as we understand that today. They came to build a Puritan commonwealth. The distinction matters enormously. In their view, they had the truth. Tolerating error was not open-mindedness, it was negligence. So Puritan New England was strikingly intolerant of dissenters. And two cases illustrate this, I think, particularly well. Historian Edmund Morgan described Roger Williams as, quote, a charming, sweet-tempered, winning man, courageous, selfless, God-intoxicated, and stubborn, unquote. That last quality proved expensive for him. Williams arrived in Boston just a year after Winthrop. He was quickly invited to become a pastor of a local congregation, but he refused because he was a thoroughgoing separatist who couldn't in good conscience serve a church that still maintained its formal connection to the Church of England in England. His peers were stunned. Turned down the leading pulpit in Massachusetts Bay over that? Williams proceeded to make himself further unwelcome by insisting the colonists had no right to their land grants without first purchasing the land from the Indians, a politically explosive position, and by arguing that civil magistrates had no authority over matters of religion and conscience. The Massachusetts Bay leadership heard enough. They expelled him in the dead of winter, 1636. Williams pushed south through the snow and purchased land from the Narragansett people at the tip of the bay that bears their name. He named his settlement Providence, and then did something that no political entity in the world had yet done. He declared genuine religious liberty for all of its inhabitants. Williams also banned infant baptism, believing that baptism belonged only to those old enough to make a genuine profession of faith, and established what is recognized as the first Baptist church in America in 1638. The case of Anne Hutchison is equally fascinating and even more theologically charged. Anne Hutchison married William Hutchison, who was a merchant, in 1612, and in 1634 they migrated to Massachusetts Bay Colony. They had followed their admired minister, John Cotton, who had already made the crossing. Now, like many Puritan families, the Hutchisons hosted weekly gatherings to discuss Cotton's sermons. It was a common practice. Well, Anne turned out to be uncommonly gifted at this. She developed strong ties to local women, and she began holding meetings with them in her home to discuss Cotton's sermons. Now, gradually, the meetings shifted to critiques of Puritan beliefs about the covenant of works, the role of good works and adherence to religious law and salvation. The group grew to over 60, meeting twice a week. What she pushed against was a kind of works creep that had settled over Boston, a cultural assumption that visible moral respectability proved the presence of saving grace. Anne made a sharp distinction. Works and grace are not partners. They're not on a spectrum. They're opposites in soteriology. Those who depend on their works for assurance are, she argued, still lost. That was provocative, but it wasn't yet beyond the pale of what was accepted. She crossed that line in 1637 when she began openly naming specific ministers as preachers of a covenant of works, which amounted to calling them false teachers in public. Her critics charged her with antinomianism. That's the idea that the elect are released from any obligation to obey God's law. As the controversy deepened, Hutchison and her supporters were accused of two heresies in the Puritan Church, antinomianism and familialism, another heretical belief I'm not going to go into here because, well, it's just plain weirdness. Please take my word for it. All we need know is that Anne Hutchison was not guilty of either charge. It didn't help her case that she was a woman teaching theology to men. Hutchison's popularity disturbed religious leaders. The real issue was her defiance of gender roles, particularly that she presumed authority over men in her preaching. Anne was summoned before the general court in November of 1637. She proved more than a match for her examiner, citing scripture fluently, deflecting charges deftly. And then she made the statement that sealed her fate. When pressed on how she knew what she knew, she replied that her certainty had come from direct revelation from God. Well, the court pounced. That claim put her outside the bounds of Puritan orthodoxy entirely. Revelation in their framework was closed with scripture. She was banished from the colony and excommunicated from her church in early 1638. Anne and her family moved to Rhode Island, and then after her husband's death, she moved further into Dutch territory on Long Island. In August of 1643, Hutchison, six of her children, and other household members were killed by Native Americans in an uprising. It was a tragic end for a woman of extraordinary intelligence and courage, whose theological instincts, whatever their excesses, were in many ways pointing toward a grace-centered faith that the Puritans themselves claimed to be champions of. A postscript worth noting, Anne Hutchison's genealogical descendants include three United States presidents, Franklin D. Roosevelt and the two George Bushes. Not bad for a woman declared unfit for our society. Now, we're going to pick it up here with the infamous Salem witch trials in our next episode. And stay tuned, because we have some interesting things to learn from that period of American history.